in looking at grief, we set up some goals and the purpose of this forum, and basically what we want to accomplish tonight is help you to get in touch with what grieving is and to be able to recognize it and experience your own grief, and just to be sensitive of the grieving process and other people and what to do and how to deal with it. First, before we get into what we see grieving as, we wanted to take a minute to have you folks all think about what your perception is of grief and then share it.
We don't mean at this point actual grieving that you might have experienced, but when you hear the word grief, what does that bring to mind?
I think of a journey that starts because of a trauma and gets worse and worse and worse, like maybe over 12 hours or 12 days or 12 months, and it goes down and down and down, and then the journey bounces back up. But it's a long cycle for me. That's what I think. At least I hope it bounces. If it doesn't bounce up, then that's another stage. But grief has a bounce on it at the end, where you level off.
I think of separation.
Okay, we just kind of wanted to get a feeling for what people were thinking of when they think of with grief. Shirley and I now are just going to talk for a few minutes. I want to say at the start, we can't possibly cover everything about grief, and what we say might be different than what you've known or what you've experienced, but at least we hope to be able to open something up so that we can have some discussion afterwards. We don't really have a pat definition for grief either, but the way that we describe it is that it's a process, as Jim said, that occurs after any loss or change, and it can be in relation to a person, a place, or a thing. Now, that's a very general definition, but that kind of, we think almost any type of grief could fit into that kind of an explanation. Probably the first thing you think of when you think of in grief, and many people do, is bereavement, the death of a person. That usually brings some kind of grief. But there are many other times that you can experience grief, and they are all valid. Grief is not only a one-level type of experience. It can be felt on many different levels. Bereavement is a very deep grief. You can feel grief with any change in any relationship, whether it be separation of friends, separation of a male-female relationship, whether it be death, any type of relationship, any change between your family, between friends, it just covers a broad range there. There's grief involved in divorce. That's a change in a relationship. There's grief in just throughout your life cycle, you're going to experience grief. There are many changes that you go through. A lot of these are called developmental changes. Everyone experiences them, and it is a change in your life. When you graduate from school, when you go on to college, when you marry, when you change jobs, all these things are a change in your life, and they're bound to bring about some kind of a reaction. There's grief involved if there's a change in yourself. The obvious ones there would be loss of body parts, blindness, things where you lose physical capabilities. You can also grieve over parts of yourself that have changed. It's different in different people. I think when everyone leaves Holden Village, you might experience a type of grief, because a loss can be anything that you once had that you don't have anymore. When we leave here, I'm sure most of us are not going back to a community like this. I know when I left Holden 2 years ago, I didn't realize it for about 6 months later, but I went through a type of grieving process. And it took me, when I wrote a paper about it, that's when I realized it, and that's when the healing came. And granted, it's not the grief as when you lose a very dear friend through death or something like that, but I had to admit to myself that it was still valid to have that grief. That was the biggest problem, I think. Many people don't want to admit that they're grieving because they feel it's not a valid grief. And we'd like you to be able to maybe look back in your life and find some times when you have grieved, but you wouldn't admit it, and therefore you haven't been able to work through it. Just kind of a little introduction on grief. C.S. Lewis has a beautiful little book called, I don't know if you call it beautiful, it's called A Grief Observed, where he speaks of his own grief when his wife dies. I'd just like to share with you the first two paragraphs, because I think he gives a real gut feeling of what grief feels like. He says, No one ever told me that grief felt so like fear. I'm not afraid, but the sensation is like being afraid. The same fluttering in the stomach, the same restlessness, the yawning. I keep on swallowing. At other times, it feels like being mildly drunk or concussed. There is a sort of invisible blanket between the world and me. I find it hard to take in what anyone says, or perhaps hard to want to take it in. It is so uninteresting. Yet I want the others to be about me. I dread the moments when the house is empty. If only they would talk to one another and not to me. I think to me that just gives a real gut-level feeling of what it must be like to be grieving. I'd just like to take a few minutes to kind of talk about what's the theory of grieving. There is no right way to grieve. There is no normal pattern of grieving. But psychologists and many people who have studied grief have kind of come up with some basic stages. Now, when you grieve, you're not going to go through these 1 through 5. I mean, it doesn't happen that way. And there's no certain time when you break out of one stage and into another. But from people that have discussed their grief with other people, there is kind of a pattern. So, but just, you know, be aware that it is only a pattern and it is not this way for everybody. But usually the initial stage when you go into grief is that of a shock or a numbness or a denial, whatever word you want to use. People use different words. The numbness, I think, is what seems to express it the best for me. In a book written by a mother who's lost her son, she talks of the numbness. She says, "The numbness stayed with me for days and would come in waves, just as my weeping and sorrow would come in waves. For that, a grieving parent can be thankful. If we had to face the enormity of our loss for every waking minute, I am certain it would completely envelop us and consume us and prevent us from ever again becoming whole." And she talks about during her numbness, it was so strange, where she felt a feeling of acquiescence. If someone told me to sit, I sat. If I was told to eat, I ate. A normally strong-minded person, my behavior was then certainly atypical. I appreciated, in fact, being told what to do. I was too numb to wish to think for myself. Conversely, I was afraid the numbness would leave and make way for grieving. So the numbness, in a way, does serve a constructive purpose because it gets you through that initial period. You don't face a reality. Somehow you make it through. When the numbness starts to wear off, or kind of while it's wearing off, people experience a detachment. They can either be detached or kind of go through a depression. I don't want to say a lot about that. From the same book, she also says, during her feeling of detachment, nothing was alive. Part of the world was real, but the only reality she knew was that her son was dead. You're still caught up with the numbness of that, and you're not really with the world. Everything else seems real false. But as that wears off, then the reality hits, and you realize what you have lost. And that's when I think that the biggest pain seems to come, and people mention suffering. The suffering, I think, at this point really starts. Up until this point, you've been too numb to realize how badly you're hurting. Again, from the same book, she mentions, the reason I use these is because I think she says it better than we ever can, because they've actually experienced it. She goes, "Gradually the detachment left, and in its place came pain, deep, slashing, gouging pain that knifed through me with only brief periods of respite. But strangely, with this pain, I believe, came the beginning of healing." And that's the other important aspect of grief, is that grief is necessary for healing after a loss. And so the reality hits, and you start to suffer, and then many people will become angry. And at this point, they are trying to deal with their suffering. They're trying to figure out what happened, how they're going to live through it. And along with the anger can come a questioning of your faith. And I'd like to go back to C.S. Lewis, because if there's anyone that I respect as having a lot of faith, it's C.S. Lewis. And he went through a deep questioning of this. He says, "Meanwhile, where is God? This is one of the most disquieting symptoms. When you are happy, so happy that you have no sense of needing him, so happy that you are tempted to feel his claims upon you as an interruption, if you remember yourself and turn to him with gratitude and praise, you will be, or so it feels, welcomed with open arms. But go to him when your need is desperate, when all other help is vain, and what do you find? A door slammed in your face, and a sound of bolting and double bolting on the inside. After that, silence. You may as well turn away. The longer you wait, the more emphatic the silence will become. There are no lights in the windows. It might be an empty house. Was it ever inhabited? It seemed so once, and that seeming was as strong as this. What can it mean? Why is he so present a commander in our time of prosperity and so very absent a help in time of trouble? The reason I share this is that we just want you to know that in grief, it's okay to question, and you shouldn't be afraid that your questioning is wrong, because that's going to happen. Through all of this, at some point, the healing does begin. And everyone experiences their grief in a different way, but if it is a healthy grieving, at some point, there will be sort of an acceptance of the grief. I don't like the word acceptance. I think what it is a way of living with it. You come to terms, you can return to functioning, and you've lived through it. As Jim said, you bounce back up. That's kind of the last, what we call, stage, but that doesn't really mean it's the end of it. Grief doesn't have any respectable timetables. It's a long-term anguish. But everyone has to come to their own way of returning to function, and somehow through those five stages, you do return to life again. Shirley's going to talk a little bit about some different types of grief that are not healthy.
Well, actually what I wanted to do is take a look at some aspects of what healthy grieving is and aspects of what unhealthy grieving is. In healthy grieving, like Kathy said, there are those stages that you go through, and not necessarily in order, and they flip-flop around it, and you can have flashbacks and be almost at the point of saying, I feel great and I can accept this and live with it, and then the next day you're just really super angry about it again, and angry at that person for dying or for whatever happened, for having your car smashed, and that's healthy. If you can express the anger, or if you can deal with your depression and take steps to counteract that depression, like realize I am depressed, or realize that, you know, I don't want to talk to anybody, but it is healing to have people around. And I think that's one of the important things to realize, is so many books and people I've talked to say the most healing aspect in the whole grieving process has been their contact with people. And not that they wanted to talk or even just have to communicate, but just having them around, knowing somebody else cares, or finding somebody else who's been through the similar experience and being able to look at that person and say, yes, they've made it through and I can do it too, and having that support. And I personally really don't think that it's possible to totally make it through without support of somebody else. It's just real difficult how integral other people in the community are to our survival and getting through grief. Some people have noted that in grieving, you can't take a large step from here to there. It's all a process of healing in small steps. You have to consciously sometimes force yourself to take steps. Like this woman in the book that Kathy was reading from, she said that she consciously had to make herself, a month after her son died, to make herself finally try to cook a meal. And that was a small step. It failed the first time, and she waited 2 weeks to make it again. But it was just a small step to start to be able to do things again and allow healing process to continue. So just remembering that the stages go in real small steps, and to take things slowly sometimes, not expect to have big things happen to you, because I find myself always having way too high expectations of myself, and then consequently I let down even more and you regress. I think those are pretty much some healing aspects of it, things that happen or that you can do to help the healing process. I wanted to look a little bit at unhealthy parts, and that's consciously or unconsciously building walls around yourself, not letting somebody else in. And let's see, I have this lady said it real well, if I can find it. Oh well, at any rate, she was she was just saying how she, when she helped her friends when they were grieving at some time, she was really put off by how she felt they had a wall built around them, and she just felt so helpless to help them. But then she caught herself one day while she was grieving or just being real depressed and consciously shutting people out, saying, when people would call and see how she was, and she'd say, "I'm fine, I'm wonderful, everything's going great, I'll be able to cope." And a couple weeks later, wondering why nobody was calling her anymore. And then she realized that she had just built a facade around herself, creating the illusion that everything was okay, and she still really needed those people, and she had shut them out. A big problem I find is with repression. It's so easy to repress aspects of the grieving, or only go through part of it and then shelve it in the back corner of your mind and just kind of leave it there and not solved, not work through the whole process, never come to the point of acceptance. And I can share a little bit about myself. I had once broken up with a guy that I was going to marry, and I never really totally worked through the whole situation until Kathy mentioned when we were in a class called Loss and Grief, we were forced to write a 20-page paper, and that was really difficult. And I wrote about that loss in my life, and sitting down writing that was very difficult for me. And halfway through it, I realized that I hadn't worked through things, and that paper forced me to work through things, and I spent hours crying over it rather than writing it. But at that point, I realized how dangerous repression is you can just leave those things hanging and never work through, and you can't really move on to the next step in life without working through that. And Kathy's going to talk about a few more.
Just two other quick things on a couple what we call types of grief. There is something that people are terming anticipatory grief. And we find this more often nowadays, I think, because of people who are, quote, terminal and are, you know, dying, and they die over long term. What people are finding happens in this case is that people work through the grieving process before someone actually dies or before that loss occurs. This can be both healthy and unhealthy. In the case of working it through and coming to an acceptance of either if it's your own death, you aren't going to grieve when you're gone, but if it's someone who's very close to you and it is very likely that they're going to die, or there is some loss that you foresee, it's not always conscious that you're working through these grieving processes, but it is found that if you've kind of gone through that and have come to an acceptance, when the actual loss occurs, it's still hard and it still hurts, but the grieving process at that point is oftentimes resolved quicker or is not quite as painful. Now, this isn't true in every case, but we're kind of mentioning these so that you can be aware of them in yourself or in other people. Some people don't understand why maybe someone doesn't grieve like they think they should, but they've gone through this before. We also want to say that you could never judge someone on their grieving, because everybody grieves in a different way too, and we have to be sensitive to each other. The other thing with anticipatory grief is what has been termed the coda syndrome. Someone has worked through their grief and they're ready for the loss, and then it doesn't happen. And then what do? You know, it's like in a piece of music, it's over, but you've got this coda on the end. Well, that's kind of how some of these people are viewing their life. They've worked through their grief, And now the loss doesn't happen, and what do they do until it comes? It's just something for you to be aware of that you might come across in some of your friends or people that you know. The one last thing, and the types of grief, is something called an anniversary reaction. And we bring this up to be aware of in yourself and in your friends. Many people, every year or at some it's usually every year. If there's a big loss in your life, every year you might re-experience grief about that same time. And it can be in the form of a depression, it can be in the form of illness. There's a lot of different ways that we do that. I had a friend, she was 29 at the time, who she lost her father, I think, when she was 12 or 13. And every year since then, she gets sick on the day of her father's death. But she does not realize it until the next day. She does this every year, but she doesn't realize till the next day that, oh yeah, that's the day Dad died. And this goes on and on and on. And it's very interesting. But for some people, when they're able to recognize this, a lot of times the anniversary reaction is an indication that their grief has never been worked through the first time, or it's continuing. But again, it's something to be aware of in people who are grieving. We're just going to close our little presentation with kind of an emphasis on the fact that not only do we each grieve, but everybody else does, and they need us, and we need to be perceptive to their needs. One of the things we'd like to touch on is the fact that sex roles do play into grief. And for instance, if a husband and wife are grieving over the same thing, it's very acceptable for the woman to show her tears, to stay at home, to be depressed. Well, the man has to, I'm not saying I agree with this, but that's kind of the way our culture is, and we're still trying to work through this. But the man is expected to go back to work, to earn the living, to keep a stiff upper lip. You know, if he cries, you know, he's supposed to be strong. Well, they both have their needs and they both have to grieve. And I think it's probably harder on the men. A lot of men they can't work it out in a culturally acceptable way, and they end up with a lot of problems and have to go and get psychological or psychiatric help. And I think this needs to be changed. We need to free men to open up and be able to grieve. Or it could be any strong-willed person who is not used to showing their emotions. We need to free people up to be able to do that. In some reading I was doing on death, they were saying the people that are normally strong are probably the ones you have to watch out for the most, because they're not going to want to show it, and they're going to need someone to let them know that it's okay. So we just would like you to be aware of that, again, in yourselves and in people that you know who are grieving. Sex roles, well, not sex roles, but sex and grief can be a real problem for some people too, because some people feel that there's the thought of anything pleasurable, such as a sexual experience during grief, that just repulses them. Whereas for other people, that is a means of comfort, renewal. It's something that is very much needed. And if you have two people grieving who are married and they have these different viewpoints, that can cause a lot of problems too. So if it's maybe happening in your own lives or in people that you know, a lot of these people really need professional help and counseling. Either that, or they just need a friend to talk to. Some people don't realize what's going on. But it's the type of thing that oftentimes we don't think about in grief, and it can be very important in people's lives.
Okay, I wanted to look at, in dealing with other people's grief, this lady, Harriet Schiff, says something real quick about grieving that I think gives me a real good insight. She said, "Grieving is a time of selfness. For those of you who feel resentment and are ashamed of it, take comfort in knowing you are not some ungrateful creature unworthy of being treated kindly. You are not alone. You are human, and others have experienced what you felt." And I think with our experience, that's real important, that in the healing process, to help others, if you've experienced the same kind of loss as that other person, it's real helpful to let them know, or just be there and say, "Yes, I've made it, and you can make it too." That's just such an incredible encouragement at a time when a person is feeling just like, "I don't know if I can survive this loss." whatever it is. Or, and another aspect is just to be there. If you haven't experienced the honesty, being open and saying, I've not experienced what you felt, and I don't understand how you feel, but I care and I'm here. And like Kathy read from C.S. Lewis at the beginning, how he said he hated the empty house. He hated to be alone, but he didn't want to be talked to. Just having others around in the community. And that's real important, one of the most healing aspects. And I think just to keep that in mind for friends and those who are around you grieving, that's one real important healing aspect that you can play a part in. And now I'd like to, if anybody has a question, ask, or would like you to do some reflection.
Either one of you, for some particular reason, never mentioned faith in healing, in the healing process.
You're right, we didn't.
Yeah, we didn't.
I'm not quite sure what to say about that. Personally, I believe faith is very important. I think the only thing I probably mentioned was the fact that you might question your faith during your grieving process. I'm not quite sure what to say. I guess from where we're coming from, that was never really included because, or as far as the presentation, how am I going to say this? Everyone's grief is going to be different, and how you incorporate your faith in your grieving will vary. I think that if you have a strong faith, it's going to be very helpful. Or it could be even more painful, because if you had a very strong faith and you're struck with a devastating loss, and if that's never happened before, it might be a real test of your faith. That's what happened to C.S. Lewis. Mm-hmm. This book was not intended to be published. This was written as a way of his working through his own grief, his questioning his faith, and he almost lost it. But he did, at one point, it returns, and it's greater than ever it was before. Maybe this would someone else like to speak to that, faith and grieving? At this point, Shirley and I kind of would like to bow out, unless there's something specific you would like to ask your eye, but we'd like to have the group take it.
Maybe you'd like to say something.
Well, in personal experience, of course, without faith, one never really knows, but you wonder if you would have made it through in particular times. What you said about anticipating faith was true with my brother. He died as I held him in my arms, and the shock, the grief of that present moment drove me to my knees immediately. As I was the closest to him, I knew that he was gone. But within the hour, I was also saying a thank you to God for taking him and giving him the perfect healing for his body had totally wasted away, and from then on I could not grieve. The funeral, the graveside rites, everything for me was thanksgiving. But we had anticipated his death for a year and a half. But a quick evening, Dad went to work as usual in the morning, on Good Friday morning, at 8 o'clock, and at 9:30 he was dead. He was perfectly healthy. there again, my faith was weak, very weak in the beginning, but it was faith that ended up carrying. But again, I had my wife, I had family to support me. And but the growth of faith was tremendous in that particular case.
That reminds me of one of my favorite songs. A line in it says, "Our trials come to only make us strong." And I think that even though we didn't talk to it, I know from my personal experience, my faith gives me a lot of strength. I know a lot of things I could never, almost anything I could never do without the strength that God gives me. And I think Paul speaks that to that too when he says, "When I am weak, therefore I am strong." I think one of the things that we didn't really say it, what we talked about, but if you're a person of faith, you might still go through all the questionings and the problems, mm-hmm. and that's okay. Mm-hmm. It's not like you've completely lost your faith or you never had it. I think I'm glad you brought this up, and would just like to say that grief is going to do that to you. You know, it's gonna catch you off guard every which way. You're gonna do things that you never did before. You're gonna think things you might have never thought, and that's quote normal. I don't like the word normal, but that does happen to people. And I think your faith will bring you through it, and maybe, and as you said, it will be made stronger. But we just want you to not think that you've never had faith at all because you're questioning it or because things are different.
One of the reoccurring experiences for me during congregations of people experiencing grief is that I think there are some expectations of self can almost be overgeneralized, I suppose, but so often people would say, "I know, Pastor Kerry, I know I should feel, ta-da. I know, you know, I say I believe in God, and yet I should feel," and it's almost as though the equation comes, it's almost as though if I have faith, therefore I will not feel pain. Or if I have faith, I will not feel separation. If I have faith, and then the other tangent is, you know, no evil will befall me or whatever. And so often the biggest struggle or the biggest obstacle to somehow work through with a person experiencing that is that no amount of shoulds in that situation will take care of that need. I mean, part of our experience of life, you know, life and birth and death, coming and going, and that is a part of the wholeness of life. And I think when people have been able to get beyond how they should feel, you know, or what's wrong with my faith, I can't accept this or something, it's as though we cease to be human or cease to experience the wholeness of pain and agony and separation. And that's the last thing I want faith to do. I don't want it to make me immune or to make other people immune to the experience of being a person. And very often, I think that, and this is a generalization that no one's safe, but I've almost felt at times people who own their feelings probably were living more by faith than people who almost rode above those feelings and somehow said all the right things. Because usually, somewhere down the road, maybe it was weeks, maybe it was months, maybe it was even years later, all that stuff came out again. In a way that had never really been dealt with when it needed me. And I think at that point, a caring, compassionate person, be it family member or another person of faith, or pastor, or whomever, just being willing to listen and to somehow encourage another to express what is going on inside is probably as helpful as anything.
It seems to me that so many times we equate faith and feelings. You're talking about feelings, and I don't think those two are the same. And I know that, and I speak that out of my own sense of experience, that it so often in the face of loss, one feels that God has abandoned one. There is that sense of, where do you hang on? Where is God? He's been with you. You've lived with him. He's been with you. But where is he now? Because this doesn't make sense. And there's where faith comes in, is the assurance, in spite of what you are experiencing and feeling, in spite of the fact that God is not apparent, the knowledge that he is there, that he cares, that he's with you. And I think that's so important to know, and to know that if your faith has been a valid faith through all your life before, it has to be legitimate now, even though you can't see that God is there. And because otherwise it invalidates your whole experience in life up until that point, if you say God isn't here now.
That brings to mind, I don't remember the exact words, it's a little kind of like a poem, and probably many of you are familiar with it, of I think someone dies and then they're with Jesus and he's showing him kind of his life as a walk along the seashore, mm-hmm. and there's two pairs of footprints, and one is his and one is Jesus, but occasionally there's only one pair, and the person is looking in his life and saying, but dear Lord, why am I alone during the hard times of my life? And Jesus says, no, you weren't alone, I was carrying you at that point.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking.
I have kind of an experience to share, but before I share it, I guess I have to make a confession, and in order to make a confession, I feel on very shaky ground, because I've never tried articulating it to a group. But all of my life, I have hated Lent until this last Lent. And the reason, as far as I can figure out, that I hated Lent is that I've always been both a little girl and a woman who wants people to quit hurting. That's why I became a nurse. I don't like it when things aren't going right. If they're not going right, I want to fix them quick. And so I really always loved God and loved Jesus, but I really was disgusted over the idea of him dying for me. And I could come down to the place where he could die, but not for me. I really didn't want him to do that, you know, and it was a struggle that was mostly unconscious. But every time Lent came around, I just wanted it to be over with. And I really disliked it. This, a year ago, last Mother's Day, I think I experienced the saddest death so far in my experience, and that was the 1-year-old son of a very good, some very good friends of ours who drowned in a hot tub. And as you can imagine, the shock of a death like that, they were out for dinner and came home, and the babysitter had taken her eyes off the child just long enough to answer the phone, and she was cooking dinner, and it was one of those moments of being hassled and harried, and he managed to die in those few minutes. The pain of that experience is immeasurable. To the other brothers and to the couple. And they were professionally trained to manage the grief of others. and they certainly couldn't manage their own grief, and I couldn't manage mine, and we didn't do real well together. All the father could articulate was, "It just hurts too bad. I can't stand how this hurts." And the only place I got comfort was from the knowledge that Jesus had hurt and had been there and had felt abandoned by God himself. And it was the only other example of suffering that even could seem to grasp what was being dealt with. And I kept thinking of the last words of that hymn, "Come ye disconsolate, earth has no sorrow that heaven cannot heal," and the words of Isaiah that talk about how he has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows. And for the first time in all my life, that was needed. And I didn't hate Lent, which was just wonderful for me. And a lot of what Schramm talks about, the theology of the cross and all that, I have absolutely no idea how all of this fits theologically. But I do know experientially that is beginning to feel right for me, and it never did before.
I put this more in a form of a question because I'm not too sure of how theologically sound it is, but last winter, after a basketball game, there was a wreck on the way home. Five high school students died and two other people. But the one girl, she was a senior in high school, daughter to our neighbor, and the only daughter they had. And I was in the cafe there where he's having coffee. Someone brought up the subject in the presence of the father. And I don't know why he chose me, but he turned to me with rather belligerent question, "Do you think it was God's will that my daughter died?" And my answer was this, that Jesus had wept over the sins of people. He wept when Lazarus died. He wept over Jerusalem. And if your eyes would have been open to see spiritual things, and you were present at that wreck, it would have been possible that you would have saw Jesus kneeling at the side of your daughter crying and weeping with you. And his response was to grab my arm, and the tears came and he left. Several weeks later he spoke to me again, and all he said was, "Thank you."
I think that's very important. There is a part of grief that is guilt. And that is the most terrible thing, and I think it is something that so often in our church we are guilty about. Because we say things like, "God must have had a reason for doing that." And I have talked in churches where people who are widows have come up one after the other saying that burden had been with them all the time, is, "Why did God take my husband?" And it wasn't until I could share with them some of that sense of God weeping too, that God does not desire death, that God desires fullness of life, and that death is evil no matter where it, how it comes, whether it's accident or disease or what. It is not God's will, and God weeps too. But we lay a burden on people that God must have a reason. And for the person who's left behind to think, what is God trying to show me through this? It's a guilt thing that is a whole part of grief that can never be dealt with until it is lifted.
I think the hardest funeral I've been to so far was the death of a 4-year-old from leukemia, who I really fell in love with. He was in the hospital for a long time, and I'll always remember that sermon, because the pastor said, nowhere in Scripture, and I don't know my Bible that well, so I'm going on his word, but nowhere does God will death. I mean, and he almost dared us to find a place in the Scripture where he willed death. He wills life in all things, and I think that's what's so important. I mean, what Norma said it beautifully.
I'm thinking about this session tonight. I wrote down 6 things that came to my mind that I think affects the eventual outcome, and certain, that was one of them. And I think any form of guilt interferes with that, the grieving process, and then obviously the healing process, and then also just how important person or thing is in the mourner's life, and also the degree of dependence in the relationship one way or the other. I mean, I am really terrified at the thought of Clark dying right now, and it bugs me because I'd like to believe I'm independent, you know, the liberated woman, but the nature of our life is so interdependent right now, it's really scary to me. And certainly with the child, the degree of dependence, you know, it's a tremendous love. And another thing I wrote down was the amount of ambivalence toward the deceased. Lots of people have a lot of guilt if there have been both kinds of feelings toward the person, and there's no acceptable way to get out those hostile feelings. You know, if you've been inconvenienced by the illness of an aging parent or a child or a husband or wife, you know, and just how prepared we are. And I've talked to Norm about that several times, begging her to prepare me. I don't know what anyone could do, but I just know I'm very unprepared and emotionally.
I think the one thing to say about that is that, you know, you can't sit there thinking about how would I deal with this or that or the other thing. No way can we anticipate what there is of either joy or sorrow in our lives. But the one thing that we do know, and I have to look it up to remember the exact verse in Hebrews, but it's where we are urged to come to the throne of grace, where there is grace deeper than our need. And that goes over and over again in my life constantly. There is no need so great that God's grace isn't deeper yet. In other words, you can't face anything in this earth but that his grace is greater than the need you have. So you can't sit there and think, how can I do that? I can't do it. God does supply the need you have greater than your need. And you can only walk in that sense and claim it. Mm-hmm.
And that's been true so far, but if I allow myself to think of all the catastrophes that could happen, you know, especially right now.
You've got to dump it in God's hands, knowing that he's given you the grace and he will.
Right.
Otherwise, we're
that's
tempting
really
God
important.
To say, that's too big for me to bear. Mm-hmm. You know.
Well, yeah, I've often, you know, I often do marvel at, I almost didn't even dare talk about it, I marvel at how graced our life has been so far. And sometimes I think, maybe it's because God knows I couldn't take it. Or, you know, maybe it's because I could, it's true, my fears are true. And then I think, no, it's a blessing, and just let it go with that and don't try and figure things like that out. But I do think about it sometimes, especially with little kids. I just feel, and I think especially having lived so far from any relatives or anything, I used to think, I would really be, you know, living in a parsonage, I'd be homeless, I'd be income-less.
You can't imagine. I couldn't imagine it. I had 6 kids at home.
Yeah.
And the last thing in the world that I ever anticipated was that my husband would die at that particular juncture mm-hmm. of life. I mean, you can't anticipate. You can't imagine. And not only that, that's not the point. You live each day the right. way it is. And I just think we beg God to try to say, you know, supposing this happens or suppose that.
Right.
You have to live drawing on the strength for the day that you're in. I have one of those hangings in my hall, and I put it up very early on in my whole experience, and it's, this is the day the Lord has made. Let us rejoice and be glad in it. I mean, God's given us the day, and it doesn't matter how black it looks, we still need to rejoice and be glad that God has given life and that he's with us in the blackness. Mm-hmm. So even if you don't know how you're going to face tomorrow, you don't need to face tomorrow, you face today, and God's with you, and so the black, you're not alone. Mm-hmm. I mean, I really feel it's that's the way you've got to live.
Mm-hmm. Norma, Hearing you talk reminds me of something that happened to a friend, and I think it's possible when you're grieving, especially for very intellectual people or people who are used to intellectualizing problems, is not to let themselves feel the real pit of despair in order to move through it and get out of it. And we had a friend in a fireside group at church whose former husband was a cancer research doctor at the University of Washington, who was diagnosed eventually as having cancer himself. And they decided that as far as the process went, they would videotape each other conversation and reaction to the stages of his disease, and over the period of a year or 18 months perhaps, they had sequential interviews with both her and her husband, and she told the story at a fireside later of what happened, and they were trying to be very open and honest about their feelings and working through the process. And on film, it comes across, I haven't seen the films, I've talked to people who've seen them, as they're having dealt with it and been very upfront with it. What she said later and what came across later was that they hadn't. And that they hadn't let themselves feel that despair, and that they had gone to faith healers, and there was a whole succession of clergy through the house from all different types of backgrounds. Even on the day he died, there was a faith healer there who was just swearing that he could do something. And 2 years later, she had remarried, and she was still angry. And the feeling that I got was that here were two very, very bright people sort of desperately scrambling to try and make meaning in an intellectual way out of something that they needed to face in a spiritual manner. And she had started a new life, and it was obvious that she hadn't worked it out, even though they had put tremendous effort into trying to work it out. And in terms of personal grieving, it seems to me that that could be the biggest disservice you could do to yourself, is to try and put the problem on a plane that you're really not going to be able to deal with it on.
One question that I have is, does a person ever finish grieving?
That's a very common thing that people ask you. Have you gotten over it yet, or have you adjusted yet? And that kind of, or, and I know that that just makes me rile that anybody thinks that you can put an experience into the past, really saying then you have gotten, put it away so it's as if it hadn't happened. I think it's like each experience in life, it's building you into what you are, and that whole experience is part of what you are, and you carry that with you as you carry all the experiences in life, and it's the making and the meaning in your life. And in that sense, grief is fresh because that loss is a part of you.
Mm-hmm. I just thought the day about my dad, not knowing that we lived in Golden Village. And he loved this place. I mean, he'd think this was the greatest thing ever. But he, you know, he doesn't know about it. Mm-hmm. And I was walking down the road, and I just felt so bad that my dad doesn't know we're here. So I don't think it ever is over. I mean, it's not over for me. I mean, it bubbles up. Every time I go trout fishing, it comes back. Every time I bait a hook, I think of my dad. Still use his tackle box. I don't think it's ever gone.
That's when you think what he'd think when he saw his grandchildren.
Another aspect of grief, if you're talking of grief over the dead, is how you remember the dead. Some people choose to never speak with them again, as if they never existed. Others can't talk about it for a while. But I think, like, I like Jim's, you know, it's probably very painful when you think of your dad, but you're still thinking of him. Some people, if they forget, then they don't have to think about it, and then it's not so painful. But there's different aspects in that regard, too, as far as what happens after the loss.
I think that is, just as you say, there are different aspects of that, and one may react differently to that. And my reaction to my my mother's death, of course, and there we were, there were several years and of time of preparation for her death. So actually we went through those same steps that you speak of there, true. But at the time of her death, there was a relief for her sake, the suffering part was over. And also, something happened to us which we spoke of together, quite a few of our family, members of our family spoke of. We actually felt closer to her. It seemed that after her death, there was a closeness to her that we even hadn't expected to feel. And we remarked on it together. This other one, my sister said, I felt the same thing. We don't quite understand it, but we accept it. We're so thankful for her that she no longer was suffering. But still there was a close, even closer feeling to her after her death. So there's some unexplained bit to me that comes after a death sometimes.
That reminds me of what C.S. Lewis said here, and I'd just like to read this paragraph because it's the same thing. It's often thought that the dead see us, and we assume, whether reasonably or not, that if they see us at all, they see us more clearly than before. So be it. Look your hardest. I wouldn't hide it if I could. We didn't idealize each other. We tried to keep no secrets. You knew that most of the rotten places in me already. If you now see any worse, I can take it. So can you. Rebuke, explain, mock, forgive. For this is one of the miracles of love. It gives a power of seeing through its own enchantments and yet not being disenchanted. And he goes on to say that in some measure about God's love, that through the death you feel even a more sense of intimacy than after the death, than when you were both there together alive.
One of my favorite scripture passages is, I think it's Philippians, where surrounded by the crowd of witnesses, we run the race. And to me, that crowd of witnesses includes not only Martin Luther and the whole bunch of saints behind, but it includes my husband and my little girl who died, and my father and my in-laws, and all those saints who are very close. They're there cheering us on, and I think that's really a sense of the communion of saints that is real. The communion of saints doesn't end only with the living, but it spans all time, and we are one, and in that sense it's timeless. We are part of the communion of saints, and all those who have gone before are with us. And we can move in that knowledge.
This summer, I guess we had been in Holy Village about 2 weeks when I got the news that my brother had died, and it was one of those unexpected type of things. And I found myself being really comforted a lot by the community and by people caring for me. And I found myself being very angry with people who only wanted to know how he had died. And it was like they were paying homage to me to come and say, "What happened?" And then I said, "Well, you know, such and such and such and such." And then it was like, that was it. And it was just, it was worse than if people had just come up and said, to many people, you know, "I've been praying for you a lot and for your family." And that was so much more important. And another thing, was the youngest child. I'm the youngest child in the family. He's the oldest, and there's like, I'm 24, he's 47. A lot of people ask me how old he was, and I would say, "Oh, he was 47." And it was like I could see on so many people's faces, "Oh, he's 47. That means you weren't very close to him, and his death isn't a significant thing in your life." And I didn't know how to handle that either and say, "Yeah, there was 24 years there, but he's still my brother." And it's still, there's still a closeness there. You know? After he died, there's so much talk about Henry Nouwen around here, and I picked up his book, Out of Solitude, and it's not really written about death. You know, it's not really something like that, but I read it, and to me it was like it was written about death. And there was the last little meditation he gives is on expectation and on patience, and in this he talks about curing versus caring. And I think I looked at our society is so much one of curing and of making the hurt go away, and not caring for each other. And the people that came to me and wanted to know how he had died, it was like, I don't know, but to me it was like, you know, a curing process and not a caring process. And it is harder to care for someone. You know, it's hard for me to go and tell someone that you've really been on my mind and you've been in my prayers. But yet, if you know, that's what means, usually it's what means something to someone else. You know, there's just not enough of that we can have.
You know, I think people really want to care, but they've not experienced it. And so, you know, we bumble around. And it's for the caring people to keep on caring, so the uncaring ones. I think, in my own experience, when I, like for instance, the first time I came to be with retarded people, I didn't know how, and I felt, I mean, I didn't want to be near them because I didn't know what to do. And after I was around them, I mean, you know, you really could care about them, you could really see them, but it's a matter, we don't know how.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
none of us know what to say. I shouldn't include everyone, but I feel that that is true with me. I'm sure I've made some of the most foolish remarks at the time of a death of a neighbor or a loved one, and to the person who had the greatest loss, I probably made some very thoughtless remarks. But there it is, not knowing just how or what to say. And I think that too, I believe some of these remarks were brought out tonight, like, it is God's will, that type of thing, and hurting someone, not even thinking, you know, and God gives and God takes away, as if it were God's will that this person would be taken away. And then I would really like to hear some of the some statements about the funeral sermons and the services themselves, whether it's really been helpful to, now we're used to the traditional, now to me it's traditional, maybe it isn't traditional, and yet I think all the type of sermon and it's almost the same verses every time in our community that's read at a funeral service, and a short statement about the loved one, and then afterwards everyone is invited back for coffee and a big meal and an hour or two of visiting and laughing and getting together, and sometimes I think that's difficult.
I think our society has a big problem in facing up to death. Mm-hmm. So I remember my grandmother's funeral. It was very frustrating for me because well, I've only been to two funerals in my life. Once was the funeral of my pastor when I was like 6 years old, and then my grandmother's funeral 2 years ago. And when Pastor Zucker died, it was, you know, we lowered the coffin into the ground and threw on the dirt and, you know, good old-fashioned funeral. And when my grandmother died, it was, you know, nice and funeral director, and there's the casket lying surrounded by flowers, and there's a little canopy over it in case of rain. And whatever was said at the graveside was said, and we all left and we went back to the church, and there was a reception, and you find yourself there thinking, you know, well, have they put the casket in the ground yet? It's like, you know, we're trying so hard to deny the death and to deny the grieving instead of facing up to it and saying, yes, this person has died, you know, and this is a loss that we have to handle. And it can really be frustrating, I think.
Yeah. Wow. Experience with death of my dad was that both my brother and I are pastors, and so we had participated in many, many funerals ourselves through the years. And a couple days after the funeral, we went back and reviewed the whole process. And it was interesting that from doing it for someone else, and you ride out to the cemetery in the front seat of the hearse and got your red hymnal next to you, and you talk about the World Series or something with the hearse driver. And it all gets to be a little cynical and a little superficial sometimes, especially if you didn't know the person. And sometimes even if you did. But what we found, both my brother and I found, was that the process of telephone call, airplane ride, greeting mom, going to the funeral home, medical records, cleaning out the drawers and the cupboards, all those processes, including the supper and the visiting at church and all that, we just needed every stage. We needed every single one. And as we thought back, as much as we knew, it was a very ritualized, stylized, Scandinavian way of burying somebody. We wouldn't have missed a bit of it. We needed every little part, and then it all worked.
Yeah.
In a 4 hours at least.
In a course I had last year, we had a grief counselor come and speak to us. He said basically what he does is people talk to him and he goes, "Yep, mm-hmm." I mean, that's his work. He's called a grief counselor, and he does more than that. But he said basically people need to talk about it because we don't allow them. But an interesting thing he noted was that in the funerals where the casket is actually lowered, if he's kind of been, he goes to a lot of funerals, and he's been watching the behavior of the people after the funeral. In those funerals where the casket is lowered, almost immediately when the pastor disperses them, people start talking. There's a hum, there's a commotion. In those where the casket is left sitting there, everybody walks off separate and in silence. It's like something isn't finished, and they're not free yet to start living. And he's noticed that a lot, and I just found that very interesting. It's like you need the steps, you need the ritual, and you need a closing.
And my mother was very frustrated. She told me about a funeral she went to this summer where in the service at church, the casket was not even brought into the church proper, or into the nave or up to the chancel. It was left in the narthex. You pass the casket on your way in, then go in, face the cross. There's a service. And all the time, you know, the body is lying behind you. And it's as if the dead person is an embarrassment, and we'd rather, you know, he or she hadn't died so that we wouldn't have to deal with it. And sort of a warped understanding. Mm-hmm.
When you said the grief counselor should say, it reminds me of the same book that Marty was speaking of, which... Anyway, one thing that you were saying about caring rather than curing, the word care comes from the same word as lament. And oftentimes we don't want to lament with someone. Paul says, weep with those that weep. He doesn't say, cheer up those that weep. He says, weep with those that weep. And I really think that's part of caring for someone, is to empty yourself and to step into where they are and share that load and help them with that, rather than coming in with your own agenda and saying, well, it really wasn't worth it, or you can get another cap or whatever.
Yeah. I think that's that ties in so well with what Marty was saying about prayer. Because it means so much to me when someone says, I've been praying for you, or I've been praying with you. Prayer is a very deep thing, and a very difficult thing, and a very serious thing. It can't just be a social thing, like, you know, dear God, please bless so-and-so. But for someone to say that, it means they're really entering into what you're going through and trying to be there with you as much as possible and trying to bear your burdens. And it's one of the most meaningful things, I think, that you can experience in a human relationship.
People are starting to leave. We don't want to, if you would like to stay and continue to talk and share, that would be fine. But Shirley and I would like to close with prayer, kind of make, you know, kind of a semi-closing. If you'd like to stay, feel free to listen. Shall we pray? Dear Father, we know that you do not willingly afflict or grieve your children. Look with compassion, we pray, on the sorrows of those who grieve, and remember them in your mercy. We pray that you will strengthen them through their trials, comfort them with the memory of your goodness, let your presence shine on them, and give them your peace. And we ask for understanding of all those who grieve, so that we may embrace them in community and support them with our love.